Hello and welcome to Political Heat, the podcast that aims to make sense of climate politics. I'm your host, Amy Mount. Now, we know that to tackle climate change, we must transform the economy, replacing fossil fuels with clean forms of energy. We've also known for a long time that the costs of this transformation are smaller than the costs of doing nothing. Climatic disruption is very expensive, and the Stern Review set this out definitively back in 2006. And fossil fuels are expensive too. In a report last year on fiscal risks, the Office for Budget Responsibility found that a continued reliance on fossil gas could cost the UK twice as much as the cost of reaching net zero. But how much investment is needed for the UK to transition to a clean economy? And what role should the state play in providing or stimulating that investment? This topic has seen a lot of heated debate over the past few years, and it will no doubt continue to loom large over the politics of net zero. So for this episode, I'm really pleased to be joined by Caris Roberts, one of the UK's leading thinkers on economic policy. She's Executive Director of the Institute for Public Policy Research, an influential progressive think tank. And before leading IPPR, she was its chief economist and ran its Centre for Economic Justice. Caris, a warm welcome to Political Heat.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me on.
Why do you think that climate investment and the kind of financing of the transition has become such a focus for political debate recently?
It's a good question. It's quite a thorny question. So I guess on the one hand, all parties recognise that to some extent we need to increase investment if we want to achieve net zero targets. Now, there are some who don't agree that we should be trying to achieve those net zero targets, but in general, we're lucky in the UK to have relative consensus that that is something that we should be seeking to achieve. Now, the Climate Change Committee has said that we need an extra £50 billion a year across public and private investment by 2030. That's quite a lot, and it raises quite big political questions if we are to do that. In particular, I guess there are a couple of ways you can achieve it, and we can get into this in more detail. But if you're going to borrow to fund it, then some politicians are quite fearful of what that says about them on the economy. And particularly progressives are sometimes perceived as not being good with the public finances. And so you have this kind of debate about whether it's possible for a progressive party like the Labour Party to be able to borrow to invest. The alternative, I guess, is that you could tax people to fund that. And of course, that's quite politically difficult in itself. So it really raises these kind of big questions about economic competence, what it means, and who wins and who loses from some of these policies.
Yeah, so there's a lot that you've alluded to there, which we can definitely unpack and look at in more detail in the course of this conversation. We're at the point where net zero requiring such a big transformation to the economy then just gets pulled into this core terrain of political debate and all these major kind of political dividing lines that parties line up along. And yeah, so it's kind of a sign of, in a way, how mainstream the climate debate has become, that the parties are now kind of looking at it on that like central turf of what's our plan for the economy.
I think it's really interesting if you look at the kind of the polls of which issues are most important to voters. In the UK, climate change comes up quite consistently, quite high. That's quite different to countries like the US, for example, but the economy also comes up really high. And so you've got these two competing priorities. And it's not that you've got one set of people who care about climate and one set of people who care about the economy. Often they're kind of one and the same. But yeah, they're both incredibly salient issues.
And you mentioned the Committee on Climate Change has said we need an additional £50 billion a year of investment into the economy. That prompts two questions. So one is, how much of that approximately needs to come from the public purse, and how much can be mobilised by private companies or by individuals? And the other question is, how does that compare to overall investment in the economy? I mean, it sounds like a big number. It is a big number, but how does it compare to just for the UK as a whole, like general investment that's going on year by year?
So taking the first question on how much this needs to come from the public sector. So we have argued that about £30 billion a year up until 2030, so that's £300 billion over the course of 10 years, needs to come from the public purse. The reason for that is that there are some things that the public sector can do better. And indeed, if the public sector goes first, it can crowd in lots of that private investment. So you can increase the amount that businesses put in by increasing the public investment. Now, when you're talking the billions, all of these numbers sound quite large. At the moment, investment as a whole is about 400 billion. So that's public and private. So if you increase that by 50 billion, it obviously is a step up. I think the key thing to say, though, is that you need to look at it over time, and you also need to look at it compared to other countries. So if we look at it over time, at the moment, investment is set to actually fall. Public investment is set to fall as a percentage of GDP. That's under everybody's investment plans, by the way, all the political parties. And even if we had this investment, we'd still be barely standing still as in terms of investment as a percentage of our economy, and we'd still be significantly below the optimum amount of investment. So although it sounds like a large number, we're really talking about the bare minimum. We're not talking about particularly large amounts. Then the other thing to say is, if you look across countries, the amount that we're putting into investment to tackle climate change is actually relatively low. So there's kind of this myth that we're putting in far more than other people. Germany, for example, is putting in 5.2% of its GDP. That compares to the UK putting in 1.2% of GDP. So there's quite
a really big gap
in terms of what's going in.
Yeah, that's much higher than I would have assumed. And just on that particular case with Germany, what explains that?
So a small part of it is actually EU funding. But other than that, it's kind of, you know, it's just the policies that government has committed to. Of course, we have different economies. Germany has quite a fossil fuel intensive economy. And so they, in some ways, have more expensive investment to make. So it's not as simple as straight comparisons. But I just made the point to kind of say, we have this sense that we're talking about huge numbers. And actually, when you think about the size of the economy as a whole, the amount of investment needed and the amount that other countries are investing is not that much.
Fascinating. Okay. And I suppose the other big, just while we're on the topic of international comparisons, one of the examples that gets drawn on a lot in this debate is the USA, where President Biden, through the Inflation Reduction Act and some other big kind of signature pledges, is really throwing a lot of money at this problem. So how much is a lot in that context? Do you have that off the top of your head, like how it compares to where we are in the UK?
Yeah, so they are throwing a lot of money at the problem. One of the really clever things that Biden did politically is that it's actually uncapped. So no one quite knows how much they're going to end up spending on the Inflation Reduction Act. But at the moment, they're spending just under 2%, so significantly more than the UK is. The thing about the US economy is that it's absolutely huge. Their economy is just really thriving right now, in part because of these investments. And so a kind of a small percentage of a large number results in many billions of dollars.
So it's maybe not the ideal comparison for the UK in terms of that absolute figure, but in terms of as a proportion of GDP, you can see that the UK is actually falling quite far behind.
Yes, exactly.
So coming back to that point about how much the government should be investing, so how much of the CCC's recommended 50 billion a year should be coming from the public purse. So IPPR thinks that needs to be about 30 billion a year, which is not too far away from what until recently was the Labour Party's promise to invest 28 billion a year into capital expenditure on climate solutions. And then we had sort of months of attacks from the governing Conservative Party on this pledge, because it was really Labour's major spending pledge, wasn't it? Certainly when it came to capital investment. And Labour then significantly weakened that commitment in quite a high profile move. So I think it'd be good to understand a bit more about that. So where did your 30 billion figure come from? And is that kind of similar to where the Labour figure came from? And why was that such an important amount to aim for?
So a few years ago, we reported in 2021, we ran a commission on environmental justice, and we convened people from across business, unions, climate experts, academics, and so on, and also spoke with people across the country about how to transition fairly to net zero and restore nature. As part of that work, we looked at the level of investment needed, and that's where we came up with that £30 billion a year figure. Now, that is kind of built on Climate Change Committee forecasts. It takes into account where we think the public sector can do that best. You have correctly identified that it is very similar to the Labour figure that once was the 28 billion figure. And indeed, we and kind of others in the space had been making very similar arguments to them that that was the level of investment needed. And so they adopted that figure and also some of the kind of the plans behind it in terms of, you know, a national wealth fund and so on. Now, that's all, as you say, kind of fallen by the wayside in terms of a pledge. I think there's quite a lot going on here, so it's worth unpicking a little bit. Mm. I guess, chief amongst them is that point that I made earlier, which is that the Labour Party feel that they have a particular weakness in terms of being seen as the big spenders. And they were quite concerned that this was going to be a kind of attack line from the Conservative Party in mm-hmm. their campaigns. And indeed, there's a lot of politics going on every time the Chancellor stands up and has a fiscal event. And what we'd seen is that the Conservative Party were trying to close down any space within fiscal rules, which perhaps we can talk about in a second. They were trying to close down any space so that any journalist challenging the Labour Party would put them in a bind, where they'd have to struggle to find an answer of how they would kind of raise that money without changing the fiscal rules. So it was becoming this kind of weak spot for them, and they decided that that figure was no longer helpful. Now, my kind of optimistic view on this, if this is a form of optimism, is that the headline figure as a whole, or as a pledge, isn't actually the crucial thing. The crucial thing is what happens. And if that politics was going to restrain how much could be invested anyway, then that's the thing we need to change, in a sense. It's the understanding of what's needed and what's fiscally sensible, and the politics that needs to shift rather than the pledge.
So what is the politics around that could you elaborate on what's kind of hampering this direction of travel? Why is the Labour Party so worried that people think it can't be trusted? Is that actually borne out by public opinion, by polling and so on? And if it is, how do you start to make the case for that to change?
It's certainly true that it has been a weaker area for them in the past. It's certainly true that people have been more fearful of Labour spending big than the Conservatives. And that's for very obvious ideological reasons, which is that progressive politicians tend to want, you know, a bigger welfare state and bigger investment than Conservative politicians do. However, if you look at the public polls at the moment, actually, I think two things are relevant. One is that climate change is a really big issue for people and they want to see action on it. And that is actually really quite spread across society. We're not just talking about climate activists here. We're talking about a really wide range of people. And the other thing is that attitudes to spending have actually shifted. And this tends to happen if you've had a kind of period of reduced spending, as we had through austerity, and the sense that things aren't working. And I think that's where the country is right now in terms of there being greater appetite for spending and investment. So I think that has shifted the politics somewhat, and we may well be fighting the last fight as progressives, when in fact there's a new fight to be had. In terms of kind of how we counter this, one of the things that we think about as a think tank is how we can help people better understand what it actually means for a government to be fiscally sustainable. At the moment, we have this sense that there are these rules that are cast in stone, and if the Chancellor breaks them, then everything's going to fall apart and we'll become like Greece. That's the kind of literal image that is evoked by Conservative chancellors. That isn't the case. Actually, if you see what, you know, people who are kind of buying gilts from the government, e.g. they are lending money to government, what they want to see is that the government has a plan, and the government has a plan for growth. And so we're in danger of kind of learning the wrong lessons from things like the trust experiment and actually saying, okay, well, we can't borrow any money. That's not true. But what is true is that you do need to demonstrate that you've got kind of strong institutions that are looking at the public finances, that you have a growth plan in place. And so I think there is space for green investment that is invested strategically, that is going to grow the economy. And ultimately, that is a much more stable path for fiscal sustainability in the long run. And plenty of people agree with that, including the OBR kind of looked at how much we're going to end up spending. If we don't take action, it's going to be a lot higher than if we do take action.
Yeah, so you're actually painting a picture here of maybe three different camps who are thinking about this question differently. So there's the public that, from what you're saying, the data are suggesting now massively cares about climate change and wants to see more investment in the economy, which is struggling at the moment. Then you've got the two main political parties in Westminster, Labour and the Conservatives, taking chunks out of each other, accusing each other of not being fiscally responsible and not to be trusted with the nation's finances. And then you've got kind of investment community, which is saying, actually, the problem with what's fiscally irresponsible isn't investment per se, isn't government spending per se. It's what's your plan for that spending? Does it fit in with a wider plan for the economy? So it feels like there's these sort of three different camps thinking about the question a bit differently, and perhaps where the political parties are at is not really in touch with where the public is at or where that investment community is really at right now.
I think that's a very good summary. There is one group of people that I would add to that, mm-hmm. which is journalists and the media, who love a good story about huge investment spending because it feels kind of exciting or scary, but don't always understand the economics and don't actually report that very accurately. You particularly have that when you have kind of political journalists commenting on fiscal plans of political parties, rather than getting kind of economic experts to explain how investment works and actually how this might end up being more sensible in the long run.
Right, so for the political journalists, they're more interested in, oh, Jeremy Hunt landed a really good blow on Rachel Reeves in Parliament today, or, you know, at PMQs, Starmer was on the rocks, or Sunak was, you know, it's more of that kind of questions around leadership and who's got the best story and so on, rather than necessarily that deep economic analysis of what's going to be good for the country.
Exactly. And fiscal rules confuse everyone, by the way, in that they're often treated as things that don't move, but in fact they change very regularly. Chancellors can decide to change them very regularly, and even the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Laura Trott, actually didn't know her own fiscal rules, as was revealed live in a media interview. So it's one of those things where, you know, politicians will be kind of grilled on, is this within the fiscal rules? And everyone kind of rushes around seeing if it's within the fiscal rules. But these are politically decided guidelines rather than something that is set in stone.
Yeah, so let's pause on this phrase fiscal rules, because as soon as you start looking at questions around climate investment, and particularly the debate around Labour's 28 billion pledge, fiscal rules as a phrase comes up all the time. And as you say, the actual rules change over time. We don't need to necessarily spell out what each one is and what, you know, the whole history of them, but what are they, and why have they become this political kind of battering ram that parties use to try and get one up on each other?
They are fiscal targets, technically. So they set out what a chancellor is committing to keeping spending within over a certain forecast. To take one example, and I won't go into great detail on them, but to take one example, one of the fiscal targets currently is that in the fifth year of a forecast, debt is falling as a percentage of GDP. Now, it's worth saying they haven't always existed. In fact, they've only been around for about two decades, and they don't exist in every country. Lots of countries don't have these. So clearly they're not a kind of essential feature of policymaking. But I, you know, in general, having something like a fiscal rule or a framework is quite helpful in terms of reassuring markets that you're a kind of sensible country to invest in, essentially. I don't know if I entirely know the answer to why they've become a political weapon. I guess it's because, precisely because they are opaque and not everyone understands them, the politicians can actually kind of tweak them to try and trap their opponents. And I'm trying not to get too technical here, but one of the big problems with the fiscal rules that we have at the moment is that they're based on what happens in the fifth year of a forecast. So if if the Chancellor stood up today and had a forecast to go with some pledges, it would be what happens in 2029. He can say, and in fact has said in the last spring budget, that actually debt is going to be falling in the fifth year because he's going to cut spending. And he doesn't have to say what spending he's going to cut. So it's almost a complete fabrication. But it, at the same time, it manages to snooker the other side, because if they want to spend money, they have to say where they're going to raise it from. So you can play these kind of political games with them. But I think perhaps more simply, as soon as something's written down, it gives people a kind of black and white, is this good economic policy or is it bad economic policy? And actually that obscures what makes good economic policy, because it's not black and white. In fact, there's lots of uncertainty in what's going to happen in the future. And you can end up with this kind of really false and unhelpful accuracy. You know, people will say, oh, there's 1 billion more here, there's 1 billion more there. But that's not very helpful when you're thinking about the long term. And climate is about the long term. In fact, if we look at what's going to happen to growth and public debt in the world in which we tackle climate change or the world in which we don't, we should be tackling it now. But that's not going to come into a five-year forecast. So that's one of the kind of huge issues with them.
So from what you're saying, it sounds like the fiscal rules are as much a creation of political rationale as they are economic rationale. Or is that taking it too far?
I think that the principle of having fiscal rules, it is both political and economic, I would say. And then how they've been taken, I think, you know, the precise formation they take can be highly political.
And if you were Chancellor, would you be trying to bring the climate into your fiscal rules? Would you be trying to, or is that a different kind of rule that you would need? But how would you bring that more long-term perspective and therefore more comprehensive perspective into macroeconomic policy?
It's actually something that we're working on at the moment, so I wouldn't want to kind of prejudge what we're going to conclude. But I think there are a few things that we definitely know need to change, even if we don't quite know the precise formation of them. So firstly, I think they need to be much more long term. We need to be looking beyond 5 years. Lots of investment yields benefits in years to come, and at the moment that's not being reflected, even though it's really key to fiscal sustainability. So that's one particular change. So there's that kind of long-term, short-term trade-off. The second thing that I think we need to think about, and this isn't actually a fiscal rule question, it's more about how we assess what's going to happen to the economy, is that at the moment, the OBR bases its assessment of how investments shape the economy in a very conservative way. It doesn't look at what, it doesn't assume that there's going to be long-run benefits to growth, for example. And so I think that's another key way where actually lots of climate investment would really pay off in the long run. And so including that analysis would be incredibly helpful. The third thing to say is that there are more radical changes that could be considered. For example, some economists have argued that there should actually be a carve out for climate change investments from the fiscal rules, because the alternative of not investing is so catastrophic that we may well be missing the wood because we're looking at the trees of the kind of detail of fiscal policy and fiscal sustainability. But in the meantime, the planet has been entirely wrecked and there's no basis for a strong economy in the future at all. There's a really wide range of opinions on this, and it tends to be argued in quite a technical way. But of course, as we've discussed, it's quite a political decision as well.
And so just to round out the conversation about fiscal rules, like, what was this politicking around them the major reason, do you think, why Labour decided to water down its climate investment pledge? Or were there other reasons that went into that?
I think there are other reasons. I think in particular, they're all related, but, you know, this was really the one big spending pledge that Labour had committed to. And that meant that for shadow ministers whose briefs wasn't directly on climate, they were thinking, hang on, what about money for hospitals? What about money for schools? And so there wasn't a strong enough kind of constituency within the Labour Party and within the parliamentary party to really go out and defend this, because they wanted investment for their own briefs as well. And that is a genuine trade-off. The trade-off isn't always as stark as people make out. Indeed, climate investment could really tackle some of the other challenges that a progressive government would want to achieve. So whether that's levelling up, whether it's economic growth, and indeed, you know, if you wanted to decarbonise public buildings, for example, you're going to be investing in schools, you're going to be in hospitals. But there are some genuine trade-offs as well if you're kind of limiting the amount of investment in the economy to that kind of level.
Yeah, because I was going to ask about this. We do hear a lot about the UK's overall low productivity and struggling public services, which is obviously a huge concern to a lot of voters who are on hospital waiting lists or, you know, whose kids aren't getting adequate funding going into their schools and so on. So if we're asking taxpayers to contribute at least a portion of the funding required for the net zero transition, like how much does that put it in competition with other priorities for government spending? Or is it the case that if the economy overall needs investment, well, why not make it green? And that will generate revenues for the Treasury that it can then use to put into those public services. You know, if you right back at the beginning of this conversation, you were saying how one of the reasons why we need significant public investment into the green economy is to leverage in more private capital and kind of really, really grow that area, those sectors, those kind of decarbonising sectors.
I think it's useful to think slightly differently about day-to-day spending on services, on benefits and so on, and investment. And typically, most economists think that actually borrowing to invest is a very sensible thing to do, generally, as long as you're kind of keeping it within a framework and institutions and so on. And the thing about investing in tackling climate change is that it can generate really good growth returns and therefore can be a really good thing to invest in. In fact, and this runs counter to some of the kind of thinking on the right, but right now there's a race to net zero among economies around the world, and it's the growth opportunity of the 21st century, and the UK is seriously at risk of being left behind. So we should be thinking about green investment as a growth opportunity. Then when it comes to the kind of day-to-day spending, really that should be funded through taxes. And so that's quite a kind of different conversation. There are kind of some parts of climate change mitigation that might require day-to-day spending, but primarily it's talking about investment rather than competing with, for example, teachers' pay or something like that.
Yes, and this is one of the things that the Climate Change Committee has pointed out as well, that it's a question of making some upfront investment, capital investment, so investing in things like infrastructure, which will then result in lower running costs for the economy, like because you cut out the need for expensive gas imports and so on. So it's about investing in things like wind turbines, for example, which then takes some money to build, but then once you've got it there, it's very low running costs and you get a more efficient economy coming out of it and hopefully one that is going to grow more kind of healthily. But yeah, so I think that distinction between what capital investment is for and then what the government needs to do in terms of service provision is a really important one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so again, putting this investment question in a bit more of that wider context, the state has a lot of powers at its disposal beyond spending power. So I wondered, I don't know if you could paint a picture of if there are other important levers that the government should be looking at in order to drive investment into climate solutions, which isn't necessarily just spending the money itself.
Yeah, definitely. I'd highlight a few things. I guess the kind of the overarching point is that we need a green industrial strategy to coordinate and increase investment across the economy. And it needs to be a whole economy and a whole government approach. Now, what does this entail? Well, first of all, there's a really important point about just ending chop and change government. In 14 years, we've had 11 plans for growth or industrial strategies, and that just makes it impossible for businesses to plan and to invest in accordance with government plans. And it means you're really missing out on business investment there. And we've had really poor performance on business investment in recent years. The second thing that I'd say is that we need to have a kind of that industrial strategy needs to be mission led. So what do I mean by that? I mean that the government needs to set a clear direction and indicate where it thinks the UK has strengths in order for businesses to kind of come in behind them and to know where there's going to be growth opportunities in future. The way they can do that, there's lots of tools they could use. The Inflation Reduction Act in the US has used lots of tax incentives, for example. It's actually been quite limited in what is used, and that's because of the politics of the US and how to get it through Congress. But we have more tools in the UK. For example, we can use regulation to shape how businesses invest in the kind of products they invest in. So there's quite a lot that can be done. It's not just at the national level either. At the local level and with mayors and the regional level, there's kind of plenty that can be done in terms of coordinating the economy around certain goals. An example of this might be that, for example, the UK has been really good at decarbonising the electricity grid, partly because we have managed to get cheaper offshore wind through kind of concerted government action. However, what we haven't done is make sure that UK manufacturers of wind turbines are benefiting from that. So we could have had a lot of the supply chains if the government had indicated a clear direction and ensured there was adequate support for those companies, or indeed to invest themselves. But instead, there's been this kind of chop and change and not thinking about the whole supply chain.
So what you're saying is we maybe need a 12th plan, but then to stick to it.
Yes, exactly. A 12th plan, stick with it, make sure it sets out a really clear direction for businesses to crowd in.
Yeah. And it's interesting hearing you speak then, because Claire Coutinho, who is the Secretary of State for Net Zero and Energy Security, gave a speech recently at a conference on innovation where I think she was pushing back against that kind of prescription. I'll just quote a couple of things from her speech. So she said the government's main role on net zero is to remove barriers and create the right market conditions for capital to flow. And then she warned of the risk that a, quote, net zero leviathan of central planning crushes our brilliant enterprise economy, unquote. So would you say this is where the major political parties differ on net zero? I mean, fiscal rules aside and the kind of politicking that goes on around those, is this where there really is a difference between the Conservatives' prescription compared to the Labour prescription for, or where maybe other progressive parties on the left of politics want to see the government going?
I think it really is, yeah. If you look at taking the Labour Party, if you look at what they've said, they've been very clear that they think there's a very strong role for an active state to direct the economy, which is not the same as kind of full economic planning. It's rather indicating where they see the economy going in future. And that's just quite a useful coordinating function. If you speak to businesses, this isn't a frightening concept for them. It's something that instead they quite welcome, because it means that they know where to invest and how to invest it in future years. There's then a kind of, maybe at a more kind of detailed policy level, there is a kind of split in opinion that does broadly fall on right-left lines about whether you should kind of, whether economic policy should focus on things that apply across the economy, or whether you should be deliberate about which sectors you support and which sectors grow. And that's kind of what industrial strategy is. It's about having a strategy about which industries you think are going to be major pillars of your economy in the future, and which you think might not be, to be frank. And that's what we've been missing. It doesn't have no history in the Conservative Party, however. If you look at, for example, the Thatcher government, actually there was quite a deliberate strategy to grow finance. And so it wasn't called industrial policy, but what we have seen is that when the government does try and focus attention and policy to nurture a sector, it can actually work quite effectively.
And when you talk about nurturing a particular sector, that's different from the maybe phrase that dogs industrial policy, which is picking winners. So it's not about picking, okay, we're going to invest in this company and help it swim, even if really it's not a very good one and ought to be sinking. It's actually about saying, I mean, it is maybe, to come back to Claire Coutinho's phrase there, creating the right market conditions for capital to flow. It's just that Labour has a different idea for how you do that compared to how the Conservatives would want to see it happen.
Exactly. I don't think you wouldn't want to entirely rule out government investing in particular companies, but you'd want to think quite carefully about the institutional architecture to achieve that. That's, for example, why Labour have gone for a national wealth fund, which would invest in companies but would be at arm's length from government, so it's not kind of at risk of that political influence.
So there's quite a meaty agenda there for a Labour government, if indeed that's what we end up with after the next general election, which, judging by, you know, series of by-election results and polls, is where we're heading. I know that you've been name-checked in the media as somebody who's been briefing Starmer and briefing other kind of ministers around their kind of policy positions in recent weeks and months. I just wondered what you would advise him, Starmer, to do on this agenda, on climate investment in the first few months of a Labour government.
Oh, good question. There are going to be a lot of competing priorities when there's a new government, not least because, quite apart from kind of events in foreign affairs, which are probably actually going to hit the next government quite hard, there's also going to be a need to, for example, do a spending review. And so there's going to be some big fiscal decisions quite early on. I think what I would advise them to do is firstly to kind of set up the institutions they know they want to set up. Because that takes time and it needs time to bed in, and it's the kind of thing that can get blown, of course. So, for example, that would be the National Wealth Fund and also GB Energy, putting those into practice in a King's Speech and then kind of through policy later, I think would be a priority. And then in those first fiscal events and in a spending review, I think they do need to demonstrate to business, actually, more than to voters who care about climate change, that they are serious about the green investment plans that they have set out. And so that should be a priority for a first spending review and fiscal event.
And when you say fiscal event, that's like a budget, like a March budget or an autumn statement.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So aside from those institutional processes, getting those institutions set up, what sort of things do you think would give those convincing signals to businesses that would then start to see private finance unlocking and starting to flow in greater quantities into the economy?
I think quite early on, a new government would need to actually do that 12th plan. And within that, set out their approach and also set out their initial thinking on which industries those are. We've been doing some analysis recently that tries to look at the UK's existing comparative advantage in green manufacturing. And we actually do have quite a few areas of comparative advantage, but also where there's potential in the future. And they'll need to do that kind of analysis and set out fairly early on where they think those areas are and where in the country they see that potential. I think the other thing is, and this is less for businesses, but more to make sure that politically this agenda works, they'll need to set out how they'll make sure that any investment and industrial strategy they do supports a fair transition. And in particular, a fair transition for workers. So making sure that those job opportunities are good job opportunities and available to a really wide range of people. This is something that has been quite interesting in the US, actually, where the tax subsidies that businesses receive as part of the Inflation Reduction Act depend on the kind of jobs that they're offering. So setting out their approach to that, and if they do something similar, I think would be really valuable.
And so is there a read across there to the agenda that Labour has also been setting out around better working conditions in general that Angela Rayner has been really pushing over the past couple of years?
In terms of priorities, I think so, because they've been very clear that they want to be a party that is pro-working people. And so I think in priorities, there's a clear crossover. I think the New Deal for Working People is more focused on things that would affect the whole economy. So whether that's carers or whether it's people who are on insecure contracts and so on, I think that's a more general policy rather than something specifically focused on where government is investing. But having brought up the minimum bar through that New Deal, I think there's an opportunity to go further where there's government investment and industrial policy.
Yeah, that makes sense. When you were talking just then about the comparative advantage that the UK might have, that's about saying, okay, we're not going to innovate on everything that's needed to get to net zero. We're going to look at a few areas where we could really make a difference. Could you explain that a bit more? Like what sorts of areas might they be, do you think? Do you have a hunch?
We have to be realistic about the size of our economy relative to the big players in the global economy today. That's not to kind of do the UK down, but with China and the US essentially in a net zero race right now and having left the EU, it's fairly obvious that we can't seek to compete with any of those countries. They're just bigger economies on absolutely everything. So we have to identify where we have existing strengths, as well as actually where there are things that we just need to do in-house, we need to do in the country for security and so on. What we did is we looked at kind of where there are existing industries that have the right kind of skills and right suitability to actually shift into green manufacturing. And a few of the areas that come up, one is manufacturing of green transport. One is manufacturing of wind turbines, and the other is manufacturing of heat pumps. And so, for example, we already have quite a good industry in terms of boilers. We could shift some of that into heat pump manufacturing. So those are just three areas where actually we think that we really could develop strengths in the future, some of which could be exported and support growth. They also happen to be quite well distributed across the country. So it's not just the same old areas that would benefit. You'd actually see kind of jobs and well-paid jobs spread around the country.
Okay, thanks so much. Because we've covered so much there, I'm just going to try and summarise, I think, some of the key points or the key bits of advice you would give a new government. So I think it's have a plan, think more sensibly and long-term about your fiscal rules or wider guidelines for the economy, and try and get up to that 30 billion a year figure of public investment, because this will help really leverage in a lot more private investment into the green economy as well. Have I missed anything?
I don't think so. I think have a plan has to be have a mission-driven industrial strategy. Am I allowed that?
Is good
that
clarification. Just a typical
researcher adding more words?
No, that's very good. Karis, thanks so much for joining Political Heat.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Talking with Karis Roberts, it's very apparent the extent to which net zero is an economic project, not just an environmental one. Not only is that because reducing emissions requires investment, it's also because economic prosperity in the 21st century requires a green industrial revolution. The report that Karis previewed when we recorded this episode has since been published by IPPR under the title Manufacturing Matters. It shows that green manufacturing has an important role to play in boosting economic growth and in reducing regional inequalities. So there are big economic advantages to an industrial strategy that uses public investment to leverage private capital into the net zero transition. If the latest iteration of the government's fiscal rules don't have room for that kind of approach, maybe it's those that need reviewing. That's all for this episode. Do tune in to the next one when I'll be talking with Miriam Brett, co-director of Future Economy Scotland. We'll be examining how the Scottish Government can get back on track after it dropped a flagship climate target. If you're enjoying this podcast, please help other people find it by adding a rating or a review. You could also take a look at the Political Heat Substack, where I'm writing a blog to accompany each episode. And if you have any feedback, you can email politicalheatpod@gmail.com or tweet politicalheat24. Political Heat was produced and presented by me, Amy Mount. It was edited by Sarah Eldridge. Thanks for listening.